Well, good afternoon, family. Happy Sabbath to you. Everyone listening in on the webcast, wherever you are, I hope you're staying strong. I hope you're feeling good. Please turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, here, Jesus, our great teacher, is imparting something to his disciples. And he says this in verse 44. Luke 9, verse 44, I'll be reading from New King James today. He says, "Let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men." Jesus says, this is important. Listen up. Verse 45, "But the disciples did not understand this saying, and it was hidden from them so that they did not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about it." The disciples had received this information that they didn't fully understand. In other words, they were a little bit confused about exactly what he was saying, and they were afraid to ask him about it. Let's turn to Matthew 17. There's three accounts of this occasion, and by looking at all three, we get a much fuller understanding of what was happening with the disciples here and what they were experiencing. Matthew 17, verse 22, says this, "Now while they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to the disciples, 'The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up.' And the disciples were exceedingly sorrowful." So while they didn't perceive fully what Jesus was saying, they knew enough to be sorrowful, which is to be grieved, stressed, saddened. This pack of people who had put aside everything in their lives, their fishing business, their tax collecting, to follow Jesus. And now they get this information that maybe contradicts the expectation of what they had, what lies ahead. Now think how they might feel in this situation. You know, the lives that we expect and what we look at going forward and how that might be threatened creates an uneasiness, a lot of uncertainty moving forward. And it's interesting to me the timing that Jesus had here when he told his disciples this. Because he didn't tell them this as they were just about to go into the synagogues and combat the Pharisees. He didn't tell them this as the multitude were approaching and they were going to need to tend to them. Jesus told them this. He emphasized its importance as they're all journeying together. They're on a walk, essentially. Together as a group. With time to think about it. Time to talk about it. But they didn't do that. What happens instead? Please turn to the third account, Mark chapter 9. Mark 9, the third account here, sheds some light on how the disciples spent this time walking together. Verse 33, Mark 9, verse 33, "Then Jesus came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked his disciples, 'What was it that you disputed amongst yourselves on the road?' But the disciples kept silent. For on the road, they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest." So instead of discussing their confusion or what Jesus was saying, they avoided dealing with that. Maybe they stuffed it down a little bit, hoping it would go away. And ultimately, they got into a dispute about which of them would be greatest. You know, the uncertainty of the group's future perhaps led to a little bit of friction amongst the group. And whatever became of this situation, did it go away? Let's turn to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, it's sometime later, of course, here, and Jesus is again with his disciples. Again, they're together privately as a group. This time it's at Passover supper. In verse 20, it says this, "When evening had come, Jesus sat down with the 12. Now as they were eating, he said, 'Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.' And they were exceedingly sorrowful. And each began to say to Jesus, 'Lord, is it I?'" And Jesus revisits his impending betrayal here with his disciples, and here returns to the surface their feelings of sorrow. And something else, too. Let's look at John 13. Again, there's multiple accounts that we'll look at. John 13, we're piecing these accounts together to get a fuller picture. We'll pick it up in the middle of verse 21. John 13, middle of verse 21. Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. Then the disciples looked around at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. They were perplexed, meaning they were doubting, they were hesitant. They didn't know how to proceed. So again, they're confused. Again, they're sorrowful, they're under stress. They have doubts. And what happens? Let's turn to Luke 22. We're jumping around a little bit, but this is the third account here. Let's see what happens. And let's see if the next thing that happens sounds familiar. Picking it up in verse 24. Luke 22, verse 24. Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them would be considered the greatest. Another dispute had arisen, and again it centered on which of them was the greatest. But this word dispute is different than the one we read earlier. Earlier, when they were on the road journeying, that Greek word is dialogismos, so a dialogue, having a dialogue about which of them were the greatest. But here, around the supper table this time, it had bubbled up, it had escalated. This word dispute means contention, faction, division. Things became contentious among the group. And it's easy to imagine how this might happen. Jesus initially had told them, the Son of Man will be betrayed into the hands of men. But here he tells them, one of you will betray me. And we read in John's account, they started looking around the table at each other. What would your reaction be? As you're there, anyone that may have harmed you in the past or didn't think exactly like you, you'd probably say, it's probably that person. That's who it's going to be. Now, the aspect and the element I want to focus on here in these situations is not so much the betrayal of Jesus, but rather the situation that the disciples were in as a group. Here they are, they're in this life together, they have left everything to follow Jesus, and these troubling developments, you know, are coming their way. They're put under stress and confused. And I want to ask, does that sound at all familiar to us? You know, for 2 years now, there have been troubling developments, been almost constant mental stress, confusion certainly abounding. And we don't really know all of what's going on at this point. It seems like the particulars are perhaps being hidden from us. Remember, for the disciples, they first avoided discussing this and dealing with it as a group. But ultimately, the trouble never just went away. It arose again later. And now it threatened the togetherness, the cohesion of their group. They started a dispute among themselves. It was interesting to me, the question that they asked Jesus shows a little bit about where their heads were at. They said, Lord, is it I? You know, who is it going to be? Who is it going to be? As opposed to maybe asking, what should we do about this? Reminds me a lot of Matthew 24 when they're discussing the end times. And they say, Jesus, tell us, when will these things be? Again, as opposed to saying, well, what should we do about whatever it is that may lay ahead? Perhaps we find ourselves in a similar situation, focused on deciphering the details of what is it that's going on, who's responsible, and what's the end of all this. But as confusion and anxiety had abounded here with the disciples, Jesus, our great teacher, noticed the contention, and he redirected their attention somewhere very specific. Please turn back to John, this time John 17. And again, here they all the disciples are walking together right after this Passover supper. They're on their way to the Garden of Gethsemane. And it's very revealing, the last things that Jesus is saying here to his disciples. And all the disciples are here with him except for Judas, who it says in John 13:30 had left. But notice where Jesus is directing the attention of the other 11 disciples here. As he's praying aloud, and his disciples can hear this, let's pick it up in verse 9. John 17, verse 9. I pray for them, Father. I do not pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. Skip to verse 11. Now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are." He's praying aloud, "Father, keep them as one." And he repeats himself, verse 21, "that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me, and the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them, and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one." So Jesus is praying aloud here, and he's directing his disciples' attention to unity. His will is clear. He repeats it four times. That in the midst of turbulence and uncertainty, they were to become united. And right now, we find ourselves in the midst of confusing times and such a divisive set of circumstances around us. Jesus' will is clear. We are to become one and united. So that begs some questions. We're all in this confusion. Where do we even start? What would it even mean to be united when there's such divisive issues swirling around us? And how can we achieve that unification? Today, we're going to explore and hopefully answer these questions. We're going to acknowledge some of the confusion of our times. And we're going to get into a few specifics because there is no power in generalities. And while it's not always fun to talk about these things, we shouldn't avoid or neglect it. Because right now we are those disciples journeying together on that road. Perhaps not quite at that point in the timeline where we're at the Passover Supper. But instead, right now we have time to discuss this, to address it together. The title of this message is Arming Our Flock with Unity Right Now. Arming Our Flock with Unity Right Now. So where should we start? Right? Isn't it easier just to close our eyes to this? Let's hope it goes away. Author Jamie Holmes wrote in his book on the psychology of uncertainty, he said, "One must push through confusion to get to where you're going." If you want to get somewhere, you've got to push through it. So let's first acknowledge some of the confusion of our times. And as a disclaimer, I don't seek to promote either side, quote unquote, of these issues. Part of my school training was to see and understand and advocate for both sides of an issue equally. And I seek to apply that training here. In March of 2020, most of us became aware that there was a global event and a lockdown was announced. 2 weeks to flatten the curve, which for me turned into many, many months of court essentially being closed. And for some of us here, the disruption continues. Now, during this time, we're told of the novel virus. We see governmental emergency powers enacted worldwide. Confusing issues begin to pop up. Was this a natural thing, or was it lab created? If it was created in a lab, did it escape accidentally, or was it intentional? What should we do about it? Should we wear a mask or not wear a mask? Should we have lockdowns or not have lockdowns? And of course, should we take the vaccine or not? Now, we might say, well, the most of these sound like, medical questions. So it's easy. We just defer to the doctors and the scientists. Okay. Which ones? On one side, you'd say, well, clearly the majority of doctors and scientists, therefore, the, uses of masks and lockdowns and vaccines. Clearly, the majority isn't wrong. Now, on the other side, you might ask, there are experts that disagree with that. And they think that, there shouldn't be lockdowns. Not everyone should wear a mask. And not everyone necessarily needs to take the vaccine. And on that side, you might say, what motivation do these doctors and scientists have to disagree with the majority? Because by doing so, they're jeopardizing their careers and reputations, jeopardizing being isolated by their colleagues. So which way do you go? The weight of the opinion, the other side, it's all very confusing. Who do you believe? You know, we're faced with this constant barrage of arguments and confusing and conflicting information. And this has resulted in quite the divide. I like to think about it as you have two hypothetical people. Person A, thinking and believing one way on these issues, and person B, thinking and believing the exact opposite way on these issues, seemingly in two different worlds. But these two people, they work together. They go to school together. They attend church together. We have persons A and persons B, both, in our congregation. And we must acknowledge that. Let's explore it. Let's push through it together to get where we need to go. Please turn to Romans 14. Romans 14, here Paul was dealing with a divisive issue within this congregation here in Rome. And some who thought, you know, because meats were being sacrificed to idols, it was important to abstain from eating meat altogether and essentially became vegetarians. Then on the other side, you had people in the same congregation who ate meat freely and wanted to continue to do so. Notice the division that arose. Let's look at verse 3. Romans 14, verse 3. Paul says, "Let not him who eats meat despise him who does not eat meat. And let not him who does not eat meat judge him who eats. For God has received him." Now, I find this interesting because if I think of two people that disagree on an issue, I can think of, okay, person A judges person B and person B judges person A. That's not the reality that Paul identifies here. He says you have one member of the congregation who's feels, you know, more restrictive, maybe, let's say, with their conscience, doesn't want to eat meat. And he points out that member tends to judge the other member. Then you have, on the other side, a person who feels at liberty to eat meat. And that person actually tends to despise the person that doesn't. Despise, that means to look down on them as weak or with scorn. You know, both of these attitudes, judging and despising, of course, they create this underlying tension. They create all kinds of spiritual issues for us. Paul said in Romans 14, two verses earlier, he said, we are to receive each other. That is, to take into one's company, to spend time with, to fellowship with, to admit into one's society. That's hard to do if you're despising or judging them. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 8. Here Paul is addressing the Corinthian congregation. Let's look at verse 8. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 8. Paul says, but food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. In other words, this is not a salvation, you know, a salvational issue. Us choosing one way or the other doesn't make us better, doesn't make us more spiritual in God's eyes. So we should certainly not judge each other or despise each other for our decisions. We'd be wise to evaluate our attitudes towards each other. Do we find ourselves despising another member of the flock? Do we find ourselves judging them for doing or not doing something that we are? From my experience, we seem to be doing very well externally, right? Put another way, if Paul wrote our letter, our congregation a letter, I don't think it would say, I'm hearing of all these contentious disputes and all these divisions. We've done very well on external cohesiveness through this confusion. But the question is there something just below the surface? Is there, as my friend describes, just a thin veneer of civility, where we're all just kind of raw underneath that? Are we looking around at one another like the disciples did at the supper table that night, taking note? They're on my side. They're not on my side. Paul told that same Corinthian congregation, to the weak, I became as weak. I have become all things to all men. He sought to meet them where they were. He sought to understand other people, and he sought to connect with them in that way. You know, taking a cue from Paul, let's seek to gain an understanding where this other person might be coming from. Someone that doesn't fall onto the same side of these issues as we do. Doing this helps humanize the other person. It encourages a tenderness towards them. In this situation, I find fascinating science understanding how person A and person B very likely got to the conclusions that they did. If I'm person A, remember, this is a hypothetical person, yes on masks, and yes on lockdown, yes on vaccine. And if I'm person A, I have my reasons. I know why I believe what I believe, and I believe myself to be well-informed. If I'm person B, and I'm no on masks and lockdowns and vaccines, I know I have my reasons. I believe I'm well-informed. Both people think they've made their decision on these issues only after a long period of time, after evaluating all pertinent and relevant information. However, studies show this likely is not the case. Our brain is wired to quickly make sense of what we're seeing and what we're observing. It's called the urgency effect. So we have a tendency to jump to conclusions. And what ends up happening for most people is the first few pieces of information that you're exposed to, that's going to be weighted much more heavily than anything else you come into contact with afterwards. Now then, and this is key, our brains become invested in that belief. Essentially, we form our belief, and then we seek out information to confirm that belief. In other words, confirmation bias kicks in. Confirmation bias is we look for and we agree with information that supports our belief. Meanwhile, at the very same time, we devalue and discard any conflicting information. And when we're challenged with that conflicting information, cognitive dissonance is experienced. That's the uncomfortable tension that you get inside. And I was reading, it's like if you're on a diet and you gorge on cake or ice cream, you know that uncomfortable, I know I shouldn't do this, that uncomfortable tension, the same part of the brain lights up when you're confronted with conflicting information from what you believe. So most people, of course, are going to shy away from that and avoid it. Now, importantly, this is important. We're generally not aware of this fact. Again, we've internally assumed that we've come to this decision only incrementally, over time, after evaluating all relevant information, where the reality is we've likely made this snap judgment. They looked at some students in their evaluations of their professor in a semester, and they were doing this study, and they wanted the students to evaluate their professor, write down that evaluation, and then they were going to compare it to year-end or semester-end evaluations. They found that on average, a student evaluated their professor in the first 38 seconds, and that evaluation, for better or worse, was the same as how they evaluated them at the end of the semester. Now, if we're unaware that this is going on, we're operating then under the assumption that we've carefully weighed all evidence. And we would naturally assume we've made a good, educated decision. And therefore, by definition, we would tend to look down on a different decision as being an inferior one. How can they not see what I see? But it's not hard to imagine the reality of how a person A and person B came to their beliefs. If person A is tuned into one news source, as they're exposed to all of this, and person B is tuned into a completely different news source as they're first exposed to all this, we can see how that might happen. So how did person A come to that conclusion? Probably pretty quickly. How did person B come to their conclusion? Probably pretty quickly. So just because someone doesn't believe the way I do or you do on an issue doesn't mean they're uneducated. And if someone's doing or not doing something that you are, it doesn't mean that they lack love for their brother or sister. Instead, We likely just unknowingly formed an opinion or belief, and then we let confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance do the rest. Now, on top of all this, chronic and constant stress is an emotional amplifier. It has an actual biological effect of shrinking the brain. It increases our hostility, our worry, and our guilt. Our emotional functions can become impaired. Our chemicals that are needed are depleted. And I think you can see that with, you get into this amped up language, this labeling that goes on. Well, you're just a social justice warrior. You're just an anti-vaxxer. And it's back and forth because your brain has biologically changed, being exposed to constant chronic stress. So if we do nothing about this, then we will default into the human tendency to think and act this way. Carnal thinking will lead to carnal division. We will be divided along the same lines as we see the rest of the world divided. But we cannot fall for this. We cannot let the confusion of our times divide us. As we know, God is not the author of confusion. Satan is the author of confusion. His will is to divide us. It's exactly how a predator attacks a flock. A flock separated is an easy target. But remember, we read Jesus' will so clearly that we are one, that we are united. So where do we go with this? First, I think it's really important to realize we're unlikely to change someone else's mind on these divisive issues. And I don't think we should strive to do so. We referred to Romans 14, verse 1, where we are to receive each other. But Paul said not to disputes about doubtful things. So we don't erase our differences, but we rise above them. And we don't have to wallow in the situation that we find ourselves in, the difficulty of our times. We can actually turn it around and use it as an opportunity to give us a sense of urgency to be united and unified. For a flock of sheep, unity is the only tool they have against predators. Unifying together and gathering to their shepherd. It's why the title of this message is Arming Our Flock with Unity right now. So question, what then does it even mean to be unified when we have such differing viewpoints? Well, the key to that question is to ask, what are we unified around? Who are we unified under? Let's turn to John 17. John 17, Jesus, our teacher, gives us the answer to all things. And here he gives us the answer to that question. In verse 21, part of this prayer, Jesus says, I pray that they all may be one as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us. That's where our unity lies. We are unified under Jesus Christ. Our flock is protected and armed with unity only when we're focused on and staying close to our shepherd. We might want to evaluate the ratio of mental food intake that we have throughout the week. Yes, we are to be watchful and taking note of what is going on in the world. But if our focus is only on deciphering those details about who is it, what is it, when is it, then we're focused on gaining knowledge, in a sense. Paul said when you're focused on knowledge, that puffs up. And that's going to predictably lead to either no interaction with someone who disagrees with you or a disputive interaction with them. Contrast that with focusing on Jesus and the Father who are love. And you approach, and Paul contrasted approaching with knowledge versus love. Love edifies. Love encourages a tenderness between two people of the same family, even when they disagree on these issues. Remember, the disciples, they focused on those details. Who is it? When will it be? And they opened themselves up at that moment to disputes and contentions. Please turn to Matthew 11. Again, staying with our shepherd. Again, hearing the instruction of our teacher, Jesus Christ. Matthew 11, verse 28, he says this. He says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, come to me, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Jesus says, in burdensome times, if you're weighted down, when you're amongst turbulence and confusion and everything else, come to me. Get realigned here with me. It will give us peace and rest. And then if we're yoked to Jesus, when you're yoked, that means you're doing the same work. We'll be doing his work. And his work is that we're united and one. When we're in this right spiritual mindset, we can't stand separation within the family. We don't want division. We hunger and thirst for a reconnection and a reconciliation with all of our brethren. When we're yoked to Jesus, we will work alongside him to become more and more strongly unified. We'll take it as part of our work. And the other person might not respond right away. The disciples didn't respond right away to Jesus. That's okay. The goal remains to work towards unity. So what does it even mean to be unified? When we have such differing opinions, it means that we recommit to being led by our shepherd. It means we realign our allegiance, our priorities, our approach under Jesus Christ. So let's shift now into how we can achieve that unification. How, when we're constantly bombarded, you know, we leave here and then we're just almost right away. The news, the headlines, and at least 6 days out of the week, we're just bombarded with this. Let's step back into our teacher's classroom here, Matthew 18. Matthew 18, this is right after Jesus told his disciples that first time as they were journeying along the road about his betrayal, and that, remember the dialogismos, that dispute rose up. And Jesus points to what I consider an antidote here, to division. In the different parallel accounts that we looked at earlier in Luke and Mark, they each have one piece of the antidote or that piece. But Matthew here records all three pieces of Jesus' instruction. Let's look at verse 2. Matthew 18:2. "Then Jesus called a little child to him, and he set that child in the midst of them and said, 'Assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven.'" The first thing he says to them is, become as this little child. Humble yourself. I think we heard about that in the first message. Then he gives an additional instruction. Pick it up in verse 5. "Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." We're also to receive each other, just like we read about in Romans. Spend time, fellowship, receive each other as little children, tenderly. Now the third instruction, verse 6, "But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble or to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck." Let's be careful that we don't cause our fellow brethren to stumble or sin, inciting them. You know, I used to not link the announcement of Jesus' announcement of his betrayal to the dispute that the disciples had, and then to this teaching about humbling yourself as a little child. But as I read all of these accounts and I'm looking at the full picture, they very much are linked. The teacher is saying, look, when there's contention or possibility of contention or division, immediately humble yourself. Remember my instruction, become as this little child. Adjust your mindset internally so your external approach with other people is also adjusted. Now, Jesus is not only our teacher, but as we talked about last time, he's our older brother. Let's turn to John 13. God does not ask us to do something that he himself has not already done. John 13, here Jesus himself, personally, in the midst of extreme stress. He was about to be betrayed by one of his own. His crucifixion is imminent, and yet his mind is on the group. He perceives the potential for contentiousness here and division. And how did he address it? And again, I form this as our older brother turning to us and saying, you know, when I was amidst turbulent times, I saw something threatening the unity of my people. You want to know what I did? Verse 4. Jesus rose from supper, laid aside his garment, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Now here in just two verses, our elder brother has demonstrated a masterclass on addressing unity within a flock. He took action and he served. And shortly after this, he asked those disciples, he says, do you know what I have done to you? Do we here fully appreciate and know what Jesus did there? Let's spend some time learning here. Verse 4, it said, Jesus rose from his supper. Now, when you're eating supper in those days, you're reclined. So he's comfortably reclined at the supper table. He left that comfort. He rose up. For us, isn't it easier to remain where we're comfortable? Continue just to do what we're doing. We don't want to get in the fray. It's hard to get up and stop doing what we want to do. But he rose up. Then he took a towel, he poured water. In other words, to me, he provided his own supplies. He didn't have the attitude that, you know, I'll start something here and then I'll see if they're going to meet me halfway. Let's see if they respond in kind and then I'll move forward for the rest of it. Now consider, by taking the towel, consider how you wash someone's feet and then afterwards you're going to dry them with a towel. By taking that towel with him from the very moment he rose up, it shows us Jesus had the intent to see this all the way through to the end. It said he girded himself with that towel. You know, it's such an important step and so rarely used. Again, the antithesis to a hot take. He got ready to serve. He got his mindset ready to serve. You know, when you gird up the loins, we've read that those passages in the Bible, gird up your loins, and in those days they'd wear a long flowing outer garment, and if they were going to be doing something they needed to do, they would tuck that garment in. They would gird up their loins. They would tuck it in so nothing would get in the way of what they were about to do. That's what Jesus did. Nothing was going to get in the way. And for us, we need to get in the right mindset and tuck away anything that might get in the way. Bitterness, jealousy, pride, anything that might get in the way of serving each other and seeing it all the way through. Now, Jesus washed their feet, which, of course, is sometimes the smelliest, the dirtiest part of a person. I think of that somewhat analogous to our potential distaste in serving someone else who really doesn't think the way we do. And, you know, some of their beliefs, some of their attitudes might really rankle our senses. Jesus didn't let that stop him. Jesus wiped their feet. That means it was a hands-on experience. Now recognize all the action verbs that Jesus undertook here. Everything he was doing. You know, he could have simply began a dissertation, a long discussion, pontificating all the ways that we should serve each other. But instead, he rose up from his comfort, from his reclined position, and he demonstrated what we ought to do. Then he tells us in verse 15, you should do as I have done to you. Verse 17, he says, blessed are you if you do them. When we do these things, when we get up and serve each other, We are uniting in Jesus. We are uniting in his attitude. We're uniting in this family. We're saying this is how things are done in this household, the household of God. So you might ask me, okay, should I bring a towel and a water basin to church and just start washing everybody's feet? Yes. Metaphorically, yes. It's exactly what we should do. Let's get really practical and look at a few ways, just brainstorming a few ways that we can do this. The one idea was we can pray for each other. And I know that we do a very good job of this when someone is sick or someone is going through a trial. We rightfully announce that and pray for them. I'm not talking about that here. What I'm talking about is maybe you open up the directory, or if you're visual, maybe you visualize the congregation and pick someone and pray for them. Pray for positive things, for strength, for comfort for that person. And then consider talking to them about it next time you see them. Compare an approach. You go to church and this is what I normally do. Hey, you know, how are things going? Pretty typical. Compare that with, hey, how are things going? You know, I've been thinking about you and I've prayed about you this week. It encourages a better and closer connection. It makes them feel tied and bonded to you. It's a way that we can easily approach that person with love rather than with the knowledge of everything we've been taking in throughout the week. And it's a way of washing their feet. Because in that moment that you prayed for them, you're serving them. You're putting their needs above your own. You could have easily prayed for yourself. You have a million things that are going on. You could have prayed for your own things, your own immediate situations, but you took time to do it for somebody else. A second idea is not wearing, for our local congregation, not wearing fragrances. It's one way to serve our brothers and sisters, because a lot of us would do it just habitually. It's just out of, you know, that's what we do. It's part of the routine. But I'm talking about taking a moment to pause and stop that routine for a moment and thinking about our congregation and consciously making a decision. I'm not going to put this on. I'm going to not do it. It sounds simple, but it actually really promotes unity. A third idea I heard in a sermon one time that the minister was saying what his wife would do when she heard of one of the announcements, someone was sick. She would look up the symptoms of that illness and she would really, the way he describes it, would really try to get there and understand the suffering that that person was going through. And then they would approach him and say, you know, I looked this up and this sounds awful. That connection, that bond, it's bearing the burdens. It's bearing each other's burdens. We are to do these things with all of the flock, not just part of it, not just with our favorites, not just with our people on our side, these issues. Because what did Jesus do? Remember, when he washed the feet, all 12 disciples were there, even Judas Iscariot. But when he talked, when he prayed aloud about unity, Judas was gone. What was the implication of that? What was Jesus teaching us there? Jesus showed us that we ought to serve everyone, all of our brethren, even those who might decide not to unify themselves to us. As we start to wrap up, please turn to 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2, let's notice a point that Peter's making. Really, the whole chapter, of course, is good, but we're going to look at verse 5 first here. 1 Peter 2, verse 5, Peter says, "You also, as living stones, you're being built up to a spiritual house." Drop down to verse 10. "You who once were not a people, but are now the people of God." That word people, that means persons that are joined together by a common bond. You know, we weren't joined together by anything. Our paths might have never crossed. But someone joined us. Who joined us? God joined us together. And he alone gets to decide who makes up his body. We're a group of people joined together not because of the name of our organization, but because God put us here with each other. Remember the disciples whom Jesus chose. How initially, when confusion and uncertainty and stress entered the picture, maybe they bickered a bit, they disputed, but their story had an inspiring conclusion. You look through Acts, they were joined, one heart, one soul. They broke bread together. They prayed together with fervor. And if you read through that, it sounds like they're doing it all the time. They just can't wait to get together. And just like Jesus did with the foot washing, seeing it all the way through to the end, he saw it all the way through to the end for that church, for those followers. And he's going to do the same thing with us. Let's conclude in John 17, turning back to the prayer. John 17, I intentionally skipped this verse earlier because I wanted to end with it. Because Jesus not only prayed for those disciples right there, but he also prayed for everyone right here in this room. Let's read that in verse 20. Jesus says, "Father, I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me, and I in you." Jesus prayed for us. And if you read that entire prayer, you can hear his sense of urgency. He repeated this four times. Let us follow our shepherd's lead. Let us have the same sense of urgency in choosing right now to arm ourselves, our flock, with unity.